Blog Talk Radio.
Without the light or the darkness comes, oh, through the night, the shadows will run. Fend off the enemy, sing out the jubilee with all the fire we can breathe. We're singing all day and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know, night time, morning time, yeah. We're going strong, heading up, down the river. Oh Lord, I feel the reveling, I feel a change on the rise. What good's a man who's lost his soul, can't take a stand when his flame's gone cold. Fend off the enemy, sing out the jubilee with all the fire we can breathe. We're singing all day and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know, night time, morning time, yeah. We're going strong, heading up, down the river. Oh Lord, I feel the reveling, I feel a change on the rise.
Peace and love. This is Trusty Training, and I'm going to do my best in this particular training to totally break down how PCI insurance works in conjunction with the truth behind the taxes or the truth behind the income taxes. I did a three-part series. I've already launched part one, part two, and I will be finishing up part three live tonight on this particular broadcast and training. So, and I would do my best to try to give it as much flavor and color positions as possible so everybody can really follow what's being done. So, without further ado, all we ask is that you continue to listen. Listen long enough, you definitely will learn something. We're going through private COVID insurance, the form. We're going to actually have a Q&A to ask people to ask their questions pertaining to how does the coverage work, what are the do's and the don'ts, We're going to get into some accounting strategies. We're going to talk about a lot of things in this 2 hours. So, again, if you want to definitely weigh in, ask your questions, you can give me a call at 516-418-5553. Again, you can give me a call at 516-418-5553. This is Bazelle Bay. You're live with WTDTA Radio. This is Trusty Training. We're going to be getting into the PCI Q&A form, and today's topic is the truth behind the income tax. Keep listening, because if you listen long enough, you definitely will learn something.
Good morning and welcome to today's BKD National Financial Services Group webinar. Today's broadcast is part two of our CECL webinar series focusing on CECL and business combinations. Our presenters today are Nancy Foringer and John Hemmer. Nancy has more than 25 years of experience providing business valuation services for financial reporting, estate and gift tax purposes, stock transactions, stock-based compensation, employee stock ownership plans, and succession planning. She leads BKD's financial institutions and financial reporting valuation practice. She is also an internal valuation specialist for BKD's Attest clients and consults on various valuation issues related to financial reporting. John has more than 10 years of experience in public accounting, specializing in providing accounting and consulting services to both privately owned and publicly traded financial services clients, ranging in size from $75 million to over $10 billion in total assets. He has provided various presentations to supervisory committees, audit committees, and board of directors on current banking issues, such as COSO 2013 Internal Control Framework, Fiducia Rule 363, Business Combinations, Capital Adequacy, Internal Audit Framework, and Control Structure. Again, thank you for joining us for today's webinar. At this time, I'll pass it over to Nancy.
Good morning. Today's webinar addresses a topic that really hasn't received much discussion yet. Most of the CECL presentations thus far have focused on the implementation and mechanics of the calculation itself, but CECL has some surprising and somewhat perplexing impacts to banks involved with business combinations. Today's focus will be on issues specifically related to loan receivables. But as a reminder, ASC 326 and its changes affect other financial instruments measured on an amortized cost basis. This webinar is going to be important to you if you have made acquisitions in the past and will still have acquired loans on your books under CECL. It also impacts you if you plan to make acquisitions subsequent to the implementation of CECL. As a brief reminder here, the effective date for SEC filers is 2020, 2021 for PBEs that are not SEC filers, and 2022 for everyone else. So today we're going to start by providing an overview of the current practice for loans acquired in a business combination, both the day one and day two purchase accounting as well as the allowance. Then we're going to talk about what's going to be changing under CECL and follow up with transition accounting. The current practice for acquired loans under ASC 805 really involves two components, your day one or the initial acquisition accounting and day two or ongoing accounting subsequent to the transaction date. Currently, the loans can be accounted for under ASC 31020 or in the case of PCI or purchase credit impaired loans under ASC 31030. The day two accounting involves accreting that initial valuation discount or premium over time as loans pay down or off, and under ASC 31020, both the yield and credit components are added together into a single discount or premium and accreted, and under 31030, there's an accretable and a non-accretable component that needs to be measured. For many banks, the existing valuation discount related to 31020 loans is initially considered to be sufficient to cover any losses that might be required under the existing incurred loss model. So there's no additional allowance related to those acquired loans being accounted for under 31020 until they age or show signs of credit deterioration greater than what was initially estimated. And on 3-10-30 loans, if there is further credit deterioration beyond what was initially estimated, then an additional allowance would be made. Now, as a reminder, the accounting that governs business combinations is contained in ASC 805, which in turn refers to ASC 820 for the definition of fair value. And that fair value definition is really an exit price notion that's based on market participant assumptions. It involves measuring both the interest rate and the credit component differences of the subject portfolio. And in practice, this is estimated almost entirely using a discounted cash flow methodology to calculate those expected cash flows that incorporate prepayment, default, and recovery assumptions. And CECL, while it may sound, some of the elements may sound similar, it's important to note that CECL is not fair value. While the concept of measuring that expected credit loss over the loan life is the same, this table highlights some of the key differences here. The expected credit loss assumptions and the measurement methodologies may be different under 3-10-26 and ASC 805. Under CECL, this is based entirely on entity-specific assumptions, so you're currently gathering your entity's loss history, and you're able to determine which methodologies you want to use for different loan segments. Under ASC 805, it's based on market participant assumptions. While entity and market participant assumptions could be similar or even identical, you would need to go through some additional considerations under ASC 805 to document that that would be the case. Another difference is the almost exclusive use of, as we've mentioned, of the discounted cash flow method used to measure fair value under ASC 805. Under 326, there's considerable flexibility regarding that measurement method. And while a DCF can be used, it's anticipated that it's not likely to be the predominant method used by most banks. It's time now for our first polling question. Which of the following is not a difference between CECL and fair value? Consideration of a market interest rate, expected credit losses over the loan's contractual term, consideration of market participant assumptions, or not sure? You're going to have about 30 seconds to respond with your answer. Okay, most everybody got that right. Both CECL and fair value are looking at estimating the expected credit losses over the loan's contractual terms. It's just that the assumptions and the methodology used for that measurement may be different between the two. The consideration of market participant assumptions is used under fair value, but not under CECL. Which leads to an interesting observation. Let's assume that an acquisition is made after CECL is fully implemented for all institutions, so after 2022, and the effective date of that acquisition is in early January. There is the potential for three different measurements of the expected credit loss of that same portfolio around the same measurement date of 12/31. You could have the target institution. Of course, they're going to have their allowance that they would have recorded using their data and their methodologies. You're going to have that of a valuation specialist prepared for the fair value accounting under ASC 805. And then you're going to have the acquiring institution look at that portfolio and use their data and methodologies for the expected credit loss. And while hopefully there isn't much difference among these three potentially different estimates, the potential is there because there is so much subjectivity involved with both the methodology and the estimates that or the assumptions that can be used. As mentioned previously, acquired loans that are not considered to be PCI are accounted for under 3-10-20, and that is remaining after CECL, as John is going to cover. Under this method, the total discount, both the credit and the yield component, are combined into a single discount or premium that is accreted over the remaining life of the loan on a level yield basis. Most commonly, banks are uploading this information on an individual loan level basis to the core system, which then tracks it for day two purposes pretty efficiently. And as mentioned, the common practice has not been to create an additional allowance immediately, and you can so-called hide behind the discounts for these loans until much later in time. And as anyone who has acquired PCI loans knows, the process is a little bit more manual and involved for 310-30 loans. This is going away after CECL. But under 310-30, you're keeping track of the non-accretable and accretable balances, remeasuring that on a periodic basis subsequent to day one through resolution. And this is being tracked either on spreadsheets manually or the third-party vendor. To summarize, the adjustments to the allowance for loan losses under the current reserve methodology for any acquired loans typically takes place sometimes subsequent to the acquisition. For those 310-20 loans, you're evaluating it periodically, but not really needing to book a provision until much later after acquisition because of the initial discounts that you are accreting. And then also on those 310-30 loans, you have the non-accretable portion, which may never change unless at some point in time the expected losses exceed what was initially estimated. All of this is going to change, though, under CECL, as John is now going to review.
Thanks, Nancy. Now that Nancy's given you an understanding of where we're at and with business combinations and how to account for them under the incurred loss model, I'm going to talk about where we're going with CECL. So the first thing I want to mention is there's new definitions with the CECL standard within that, and that's ASC 326. There's the definition of PCD, purchase credit deteriorated loans on an individual basis or a pool basis, and everything else is going to be non-PCD. And further on, we will talk about what would be classified as a PCD credit and then to also talk about what could not be considered non-PCD. Within the CECL standard, you still have the ASC 805, as Nancy mentioned, under business combination that refers back to ASC 820 of how to define a purchase price from a market participant standpoint. And that's the part where you still may need a use of specialists in determining that valuation. Many of you have used some in the past that have done acquisitions. But if you have not done them, you may still need a specialist to help you involved on any acquisitions in the future under CECL. And I'm also going to talk about day two purchase accounting. As we all would expect, there's going to be day two impacts that we need to consider and evaluate going forward after we make that initial day one adjustment. And then also talk about the concept of what the allowance is going to look like under the expected credit loss model under ASC 326. Counting for business combinations under CECL is going to need to be looked at differently than what we currently are doing. Deal structures may be looked at differently and what prices are being paid or what's being booked as credit discounts. So things to keep in mind as we continue on with this presentation of if any deals that I've done in the past, how could they change in the future under CECL as we talk about these changes? I want to reemphasize, very important to know that PCI goes away under 310-30. Nancy mentioned that as well, but 310-30 kind of gets alleviated into ASC 326 for the CECL standard. So, and PCI goes away and it rolls into what's now classified as PCD, those purchase financial assets with credit deterioration. And the official definition of that is acquired individual financial assets or groups of financial assets with similar risk characteristics that as of the date of acquisition have experienced a more than insignificant deterioration in credit quality since origination. And that's determined by an acquirer's assessment. We put extra emphasis into that because from one financial institution to another, that may be different. There's a lot of leniency here on what can be defined as credit deterioration. We will go over that as well. But there needs to be consensus within your organization of starting point of what you're going to determine credit deterioration to be. And it's also important to know that PCD, you need to look at it from a perspective of assets that share similar risk characteristics from a group or pooling level. Can be grouped together or pooled, but those that do not have similar risk characteristics cannot be grouped or pooled together. So we keep talking about PCD. You know, there seems to be more leniency if you haven't caught on to that already, but some factors actually that listed within the standard that should be considered, and the reference there is ASC 326-2055-59. So a few listing here, and there's a lot of open-ended concepts that could also be placed within the determination to classify a PCD asset, but a few that we want to talk about are financial assets that are delinquent as of the acquisition date. So you would look at it from your eyes of whatever your policy is for delinquencies. You know, normally that's pretty consistent amongst or many banking organizations, but if it's different for you, you may have a different point of view of what a delinquent credit is versus your seller. That's something to consider. You also have financial assets that have been downgraded since origination. So there it would be important if you could obtain information from the sellers if there's credits that are being moved around from certain gradings. It may be a past grading. It may move down to a classified asset. Being able to look at that over a period of time from the seller's perspective, how they're grading those would be beneficial to an acquirer looking at that the loan portfolio and determining what a PCD asset is.
All right, family, that was the CECL and business breakdown, and I will be bringing that back into rotation on 365. I want to give you a little bit of that so you can kind of get your feet wet in terms of exactly what we're going to be talking about with dealing with private COVID insurance, talking about the actual platform in terms of you guys actually utilizing your funding if you are in arbitration, if you're making real estate purchases, if you're doing anything dealing with trust. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to attempt in this particular training to tie it all together so everybody's perfectly clear on what to do and what not to do. For those of you that have not had a chance to refer to the series entitled The Truth About the IRS, The Truth About the Income Tax, I did a part one, a part two, and for everybody's blessings, I'm going to be actually doing part three live in this particular training session. So, you understand that CECL has been introduced into the financial space. It is the new accounting standard that governs all businesses that deals with finance, deals with Federal Reserve notes. If you are a financial institution, you are quote-unquote in that space. Now, as they used to say back in Hollywood, here's the rest of the story. The Truth About the Income Tax or the IRS Fraud Exposed. This was written by Thomas Fried. The Truth About the Income Tax, the introduction. The Constitution of the United States of America, the supreme law of the land, establishes a limited federal government in America. Limited means restricted by supreme law. That means that if something is not explicitly authorized in the Constitution, then the federal government is prohibited from engaging in that activity. And the government is, of course, supposed to be also prohibited from doing anything that the Constitution explicitly forbids it from doing. The constitutional framework for taxation. Now, the Constitution, of course, authorizes the federal government to lay and collect taxes in order to establish or ensure the operations of sovereignty of the government and nation. However, because the founding fathers truly did understand the powers of the power to tax is indeed the power to destroy, it does so very specifically and carefully in order to ensure that the taxing authorities would never become the same tyrant, which was the King of England, and his hordes of tax collectors that the Constitution was created in order to permanently vanquish. So the Constitution very carefully divides the power to tax into two categories, direct and indirect taxation. Indirect taxes are authorized to provide for the operation of the government and its legitimate functions and are made subject to the rule of uniformity, which simply means that everyone must be treated the same and is taxed the same rate as everybody else for similar activities. Direct taxes are authorized to ensure that sovereignty of a nation to pay debts off in a timely manner, and that they are made subject to the rule of apportation. According to the last census, now that the rule of apportionment means the federal government does not collect direct taxes from citizens, it collects them from the state governments. Each state government treasury is responsible for its citizens' proportionate share of the total direct tax laid by Congress. The proportionate share that each state must pay is calculated based on the population count for the state in the last census, which was taken. So if 10% of the population counted in the last census lived in California, and the California government would have to come up with 10% of the direct tax that was laid by Congress. Please notice that in order to tell each state how much its share is, and therefore how much it must pay, Congress must specify exactly how much money it is to be raised by this direct tax. Once the amount to be raised by the tax is fixed, then and only then can the states begin making arrangements to raise money and pay the taxes. Otherwise, the states would know neither how much money to raise above the existing treasury levels nor how much they were actually liable to pay. So direct taxes are never paid by the citizens to the federal government directly. They are paid by the state government, thus preventing the tyranny that inadvertently results when the government arrives at the doorsteps of the citizens and demands arbitrary amounts of money from them in the name of a tax. The Founding Fathers were very familiar with the tyrannical reality that they removed this cancer from American landscape forever, or at least they thought they had, by constitutionally forbidding the federal government from ever taxing the citizens directly, unless apportioned to the states for collections. Now, indirect taxes, imposts, duties, and excises are also rarely collected by the federal government itself, except at the borders. Indirect taxes are generally collected by third parties that are not employed by the federal government directly, but are merely collecting taxes for the government as a function of their own business. For instance, the liquor store, the drug store, the gas station, the airlines, etc. In all these cases, indirect taxes are peacefully and orderly collected and paid over to the federal and state governments without the taxpayer ever having to confront or deal with the former government. An individual either pays the tax at the cash register, which they should know about ahead of time, and chooses to do so, or they don't get to buy the liquor, gas, etc. at the store. If you don't want to pay the tax, you don't have to. You can go home and make your own beer, grow your own tobacco, farm your own food, etc. And because the government is rarely directly involved in any of this tax collections from the public and never forces anyone to pay a tax that they don't want to pay, the system works without creating any animosity between the government and its citizens. Please notice that under the legitimate constitutional scheme of taxation, the federal government is never allowed to demand money from the citizens in the name of a tax. It doesn't matter if the tax is direct or indirect. The federal government is prohibited from demanding money from we the people. The reason why the Founding Fathers understood completely that direct taxation of the people by the state is the definition and the very essence of tyranny, because no individual, regardless of how wealthy or powerful he or she might be, can withstand the might of the state if it is allowed to bring that might to bear against the individual citizen. The IRS fraud exposed. Truth about the income tax. The myth. In the early centuries AD, men feared fire-breathing dragons, a great mystical creature of undeterminable, undefeatable power, which burned individual men to ashes with a single breath. Today, believe it or not, we live with the same myth about a creature of great, undefeatable power. Our dragon, our nation's curse and disgrace, our beast is, of course, the IRS. Most Americans fear the IRS out of ignorance of the law. Knowledge dispels hysterical fears of the unknown and makes possible the vanquishing of our foes. This information web pages have been assembled in the effort to help all Americans overcome their own unfounded hysterical fears of the IRS by making them knowledgeable about the law imposing income taxes, how those laws affect you, the American citizen. Once you know the truth about the tax laws, the unconstitutional and illegal reign of terror orchestrated by the IRS in America for over 50 years will finally be over. The code has been broken. The Paperwork Reduction Act of 1980 is the key to exposing and understanding the truth about the American tax laws. The truth has been in print, the code, since 1916, and reaffirmed in print again recently. In 1985, when the IRS complied with the mandates of the Paperwork Reduction Act by providing the Office of Management and Budgets, the OMB, and the table shown in Title 26 CFR 602.101, the stage was set to affect the end of the IRS in America. The IRS cannot ask you for more information under any given code section than this table shows is required by that code. This table is from Title 26, the Internal Revenue Code, comma, the Code of Federal Regulations, which is the CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations, which implemented the United States Code, what we call USC sections, provided for the legal reduction of paperwork and the administrative costs associated with its maintenance. The following is showing the actual legal code sections that the IRS itself cites and invokes should serve as proof beyond any reasonable doubt whatsoever that the income tax laws are being intentionally misapplied to all American citizens in America in order to fund an unspoken, un-American political agenda of social global control. To understand just how important the Paperwork Reduction Act is to the tax laws, keep in mind that since 1980, the IRS has been required by law to provide a notice of it under Notice 609 with every single piece of correspondence they issue to individuals. You can find a complete copy of this notice on page 1 of any Form 1040 tax instruction booklet. But the IRS won't tell you about the Code of Federal Regulations, where you can look up the information, collections form, requirements of any given code section. They just tell you that you're supposed to know the law. Well, after reading this book, you will. Chapter 1. Implementation. United States Code Annexed General Index. Where does one begin an examination of the United States tax laws? The United States Code is voluminously and very complex. So let us start at the beginning. Here in the General Index for the United States Code Annexed from 1994, under the major heading Citizenship, we try to find an entry for the income tax, but we can only find the word citizenship. Continue, is dealing with illegitimate children under Title 8, subsection 1409. Immigration, this index, we talk about imprisonment, citizens by foreign governments under Title 22, 732, detention of citizens prohibited except by Act of Congress, Title 18, subsection 4001. And then we deal with Indians, generally subsection 8, subsection 1401. Where's the income tax? There is nothing listed or shown for income tax in the general index under citizenship. It would be there it would be there between imprisonment and Indians. If it existed, it's not listed. There are no income tax code statutes shown here in the general index as being applicable under citizenship because, as you will see, the income tax does not apply to a citizen's domestic earnings and income earned by right. The law accordingly records that legal fact. Here in the general index again, we see the entries for the citizenship on the citizens under the major heading income tax. Now, when you get to the income tax, it says citizens about to depart from the U.S. waiver of requirements at the termination of taxable year, Title 26, subsection 6851, living abroad exclusive to earned income and foreign housing costs for general income tax, Title 26, subsection 911, under civic leagues. How many code sections are shown here in the general index as being applicable to citizens under income tax? There are two sections, and they both have to do with what? They both have to do with foreign countries. So here in the general index for the annex code, we immediately get our first indication that the income tax laws may be substantially different than what we have been led to believe is true by our government. Furthermore, if one looks up income tax under the major headings of aliens in this general index, one will find 9 pages of codes sections listed as being applicable. 8 of those pages relate to the income tax sections relevant to non-resident aliens. The income duty of 1861. Most people in America believe that the income tax first started in America between 1913 and 1916. This is not correct. The income tax first appeared in the law at the beginning of the Civil War in 1861. The text of the law read, income duty, section 89. And be it further enacted that for the purpose of modifying and reenacting as hereinafter provided, so much of an act entitled an act to provide increased revenues from imports to pay interest on the public debt and for other purposes. Approved 5th of August 1861 as it relates to income tax. The first income tax was an income duty imposed by the duty of revenue derived from foreign imports imposed as foreign tax duty. Duties are collected at the ports of entry to a nation. They are not imposed on domestic activities. Also in 1860 and in 1862, along with the income duty of 1861, Congress passed an act into law that can only and most accurately be described as the Federal Employment Kickback Agreement. The text of the act reads, the Federal Employee Kickback, Section 86, it talks about salaries and pays of officers and persons in the service of the United States and passports. Under Section 86, and it be further enacted that on and after the first day of August 1861, there shall be levied, collected, and paid on all salaries of officers or payments to persons in the civil, military, naval, and other employments of the service of the United States, including senators, representatives, delegates in Congress, when exceedingly the rate of $600 per annual, a duty of 3% centum on the excess above, and said $600 has said and shall be the duty of all paymasters and all dispersing officers under the government of the United States or in employed thereof when making any payments to officers, persons as aforesaid, upon settling and adjusting the accounts of such officers and persons to deduct and withhold an aforesaid duty of 3% and shall at the same time make a certificate stating the name of the officer or person for whom such deduction was made and the amount thereof, which shall be transmitted to the officer of the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue and entered as part of the internal duties and the payroll receipts or account of officers or persons paying such duty, as aforesaid, shall be made to exhibit the fact of such payment. Balance of Section 8.6 applies to passports. Emphasis added. Please note that the only people who are subject to this duty be clear statutory, by clear statutory language, by clear statutory language, are federal employees. The effect of Section 86 identifies what it really is, a kickback, a part of the property agreed under the employment contract to be paid for the labor of the federal government employees. By this act, the amount of compensation contractually agreed was unilaterally diminished by one party to the agreement, that was Congress, without the consent of the other party, the federal government. A unilateral change in the unemployment contract of all persons already employed of the federal government was and is not legal, and the conduct of the United States judges for the next 70 years proves it, as they refused to pay this duty until after 1932, thus becoming, according to the IRS, the first tax protesters in American history. Did you just get that? The United States judges, their refusal to do this act, they became the first tax protesters. And now you wonder why we have current expected credit loss provisions. Family, I hope this information has opened your eyes. I got more exclusive content to come. Just want to let you know there's far more to this, and you got to learn the truth about the income tax. Peace and love, family. Peace and love. All right, family. The actual first recorded tax protesters were United States Supreme Court justices who refused to pay a 3% tax because they knew the truth. A lot of what I've experienced in this whole movement has been because a lot of individuals in commerce, they hear the truth, but they don't quite let it resonate that, okay, I'll give you an example. There's two types of money in circulation, money of exchange and money of account. If you use your Social Security number in the commercial system, you are not a creditor, you are a debtor. And you can't pay a debt with a debt. Property cannot own property. The greater has influence over the lesser. And you're either going to be worthy to learn or worthy to serve. Taxes are voluntary. And if you are in commerce, using the social, or have ever used the social, until you change your mind, the body goes where the mind is. There exists a system that has monetized you since birth, and they operate with complete anonymity. Immunity, privacy, because it's never personal business. Oh, I want to get control of my straw man account, and I'm going private, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and blah, 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 blah. Well, in order for you to do that, you got to do what they call a CTR. And if you don't know what a CTR is, then you need to refer to Operating Circular 10. And if you don't know what Operating Circular 10 is, I suggest you get back on the porch, grasshopper, because you don't understand the truth behind the income tax. The judges were the first tax protesters because they knew the truth. Now, part two of the truth about the income tax is even deeper. Why? Now, while I'm broadcasting, because the powers that be are doing everything they can to prohibit this truth from coming out, I'm going to do something that, you know, you can't let the left hand know what the right is doing. So with that being said, I'm going to make this information available. So here's what I'm going to do. Let me stop this recording and then start a new recording. Because what we're going to cover in this particular segment is going to be the truth about the IRS Part 2. Why did the judges refuse? And how come no one talks about the first tax protesters? But yet anyone that doesn't comply with what they lay out ultimately becomes a tax protester or a tax fugitive. Who made the word tax fugitives actually infamous was a Barack Hussein Obama. See, there was an executive order that was passed by Barack Hussein Obama that made anyone that does not know what I'm about to say a tax fugitive. So we now go into the truth about the income tax part two, and we pick up where we left off earlier where the judges refuse. Now, for those of you that actually will be seeing this particular video, you can actually see my screen as I go through this. Those of you that are in this particular segment on Blog Talk, keep your shirt on. I'll share this with you later on. All right, the truth about the income tax. Here we go. See, in 1863, the Supreme Court Chief Justice Tierney sent a letter to the Secretary of Treasury attacking the implementation of the Section 86 on the compensation of the federal judges as being unconstitutional. This letter was also published as Supreme Court decision under 157 United States Statute 701. And in it, Justice Tierney stated that the act in question, as you interpret it, diminishes the compensation of every judge 3% by 3%. And if it can be diminished to that extent by the name of a tax, it may in the same way be reduced from time to time at the pleasure of the legislator. Here you can see that the judges understood the effect of this law was a diminishment by the name of a tax. See, they knew that it was not an actual tax, but a forced debt obligation. In this country, there exists no circumstance upon which persons lawfully can be forced to accept the debt against their will. The judges chose to exercise their right to refuse to accept this debt. The facts presented above were expressed by the Supreme Court in the case entitled Pollock versus Farm Loan Trust Company. And it's actually an 1895 case. This is what it said. Subsequently, in 1869, the question arose whether the law which imposed such a tax upon them was unconstitutional. The opinion of the Attorney General thereof was requested by the Secretary of Treasury. The Attorney General, in reply, gave an elaborate opinion in advising the Secretary of Treasury that no income tax can be lawfully assessed and collected upon the salaries of those officers, notaries or officers, of those officers who were in office, if you are a notary, you're in office, at the time of the statute imposing the tax, which was passed, holding that on this subject, the views expressed at the Chief Justice Tierney, and his opinion was also published in the volume 13 of the opinion of Attorney General on page 161. So notaries, if you don't understand what I'm going to say, I'm going to say it plainly. Your law that you stand on, quote unquote, when it comes to being subject to the tax has already been put into the judge's opinion on page 161 under the opinion of the Attorney General in volume 13. And it goes all the way back to 1895. See, the kickback program illegally forced 3% debt obligations upon federal government employees working under the existing employment agreement in 1862. However, the kickback program established by Section 86 was legal when applied to the salary of persons who took employment with the federal government after the act was passed, because they were on notice that a 3% kickback was part of their employment agreement. See, this tax, I want you to notice that even when you read it, it doesn't even call it a tax in the act. It calls it a duty. So this duty applies to federal employees. It is these two acts from the 1860s, which is entitled, write this down, the Foreign Income Duty and the Federal Employment Agreement, the kickback. These were blurred by under the 16th Amendment distractions, who provisions had been intentionally mingled, they go that word commingled, it was mingled by the IRS with the Social Security provisions of the 1930s. So when they introduced the Social Security system in the 1930s, they commingled because you didn't understand that it was a federal income duty, not a tax. And it only applies to federal employees. See, the IRS, let me back up. See, you got to understand that the Social Security provisions of the 1930s, they have become today's so-called income tax. And they were actually put in place not by proper changes in law, but by improper enforcement procedures by a renegade IRS that was brutally and illegally intimidating, coercing, and prosecuting good American citizens by threat in order to force them to pay a so-called income tax that they legally never owed in the first place because they were never subject to it under the law because they never worked for the federal government or earned a foreign income under the treaty. If you don't believe me, then now we come to the part where it talks about a note from the commissioner. If we look at the IRS, if we look at what the Internal Revenue Service tells us today, I spoke to them today. So when I spoke to them today, they tell us about the income tax on the first page of every form 1040. And matter of fact, if you can find an actual IRS booklet that goes back to 94, you'll find a note from the commissioner. And this note from the commissioner, which is usually one of the first things in the booklet, see, I think, yeah, Margaret Richard wrote this one. So this one is from Margaret Richardson, who was the current commissioner of the IRS. And it states in part, this is what she said. Dear taxpayer, thank you for making this nation's tax system the most effective system of voluntary compliance in the world. The key to maintaining that system is ensuring that you are treated fairly and equitably, that your privacy is protected, and that our tax system is as simple and understandable as possible. Signed by Margaret Milliner Richardson. And there it is, voluntary compliance. Why does she say that? What does that mean? Does that seem strange to you, given the IRS known position in court? And how does it affect you? You know, you being a sovereign American citizen, if compliance really is voluntary. We will come back to those questions in a bit. But I will point out here that this opening statement is not unusual. Nearly every instruction booklet from past years have opened with some variation of this statement from the commissioner. But how many of you guys actually read the IRS booklets? See, the next thing we're going to have to take a look at is the Privacy Act and the Paperwork Reduction Act. You know, when they send you that notice 609. See, that's required by law. They got to supply it to you, but, you know, whenever they send any correspondence. You know, whenever the IRS wants to send you something and you have not done what they asked you to do, then they got to give you a notice 609. But let's talk about it. See, it states in the pertinent part, it'll say the Privacy Act and the Paperwork Reduction Act, notice 609. The Privacy Act of 1974, I keep telling you there's a Privacy Act, trustees, that you can't violate when you know this information. I'm trying to show you. Okay, the Privacy Act of 1974 and the Paperwork Reduction Act of 1980 says that when we ask you for information, we must first tell you our legal right to ask for the information, why we are asking for it, and how it will be used. We must also tell you what could happen if we do not receive it, and whether your response is voluntary, required to obtain a benefit, or mandatory under law. This notice applies to all papers you file with us, including this tax return. It also applies to any questions we need to ask you so we can complete, correct, and process your return, figure your tax, and collect tax, interest, or penalties. Our legal right to ask for information is Internal Revenue Code Section 6001, 6011, and 6012 Subsection A and their regulations. They say that you must file a return or statement with us for any tax you are liable for. Your response is mandatory under these sections. We ask for your tax information to carry out the tax laws of the United States. We need it to figure and collect the right amount of tax. If you do not file a return, do not provide the information we ask for, or if you provide fraudulent information, the law says that you may be charged penalties. And in certain cases, you may be subject to criminal prosecution. Please keep this notice with your records. It may help you if we ask for other information. If you have questions about the rules for filing, giving information, please call or visit any Internal Revenue Service office. Watch this. In the third paragraph, it states, our legal right to ask for information is Internal Revenue Code Section 6001, 6011, 6012, Subsection A, and their regulations. They say that you must file a return or statement with us for any tax you are liable for. Now, does that say you have to file a return for taxes that you're not liable for? No. Does it state who is liable? No. Does it even state what liability is? No. And that raises the legal questions. What is liability? Who is liable? We'll come back to these questions later on. Now, keep in mind that this does not actually say that this is their right to ask you, the citizen, for information. It doesn't actually specifically says from whom information may be requested. It just establishes that a legal right to request information does exist. But from whom may information actually be requested under these laws? Well, they cite three code sections in this notice. What do those code sections say? Well, 6001 is the notice or regulations requiring records and statements and special returns. It starts out by saying every person liable for any tax imposed by this title for collecting thereof shall keep such records, render such statements, make such returns, and comply with such rules, regulations as the secretary may from time to time prescribe. Whenever in the judgment of the secretary it is necessary, he may require any person by notice served upon such persons or by regulations to make such returns, render such statements, or keep such records as the secretary deems sufficient to show whether or not such persons is liable for tax. The only records which an employer shall be required to keep under this section in connection with charge tips shall be charge receipts, records necessary to comply with section 6053 subsection C, and copies of the statements furnished by the employees under section 6053 subsection A. Notice that the first three words of this code says every person liable. Does this code section actually establish liability? Or does it simply list the consequences of being liable, leaving the reader to assume that he or she is in fact made liable elsewhere in the code? Indeed, it does not establish liability. It merely lists consequences of being liable. It is interesting to note that the second sentence here says, whenever in judgment of the secretary it is necessary, he may require any person by notice served upon such persons by regulations to make such returns, render such statements, or keep such records as the secretary deems sufficient to show whether or not such person is liable for tax. Have you ever received notice from the commission? And this is where I'm going to ask questions because I want to see who's paying attention. Now, I'm going to call up on you by the last four digits of your phone number. My question to you, if you ever dealt with the IRS, have you ever seen a notice or received a notice from the commission? All right, we'll go to the first caller here. Caller, last four digits of your number is 0375. 0375. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All
right. Repeat the question again.
Question is, have you ever received any type of notice from the IRS? And if you did, did it come directly from the IRS commission?
Oh, wow. This is all new to me. So to be honest, I'm not sure how to answer the question. Would say I have received IRS notice, but I'm not sure. I'm going to go with no, it did not.
Okay. That's fair. I'm trying to literally see where everybody's at, because this is what they do, and we want to make sure that all trustees are aware of really what's happening. So hold that thought. I'm going to go down the line. Let's see. All right, caller, last 4 digits of your number is going to be 1796. 1796, if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right. Have you ever in life ever received any type of notice from the IRS? And if you did, was this correspondence directly from the IRS commissioner?
No.
All right. Beautiful. Hold that thought. I'm coming back to you. One more. Call the last 4 digits of your number, 0469. 0469. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Same question. Have you ever received a notice from the IRS? And if you have, was this notice directly from the IRS commissioner?
I received the notice, but I'm not sure if it's directly from the IRS.
All right. So in your leisure, in your spare time, you want to look at your notice that you got to see that it actually come directly from the commissioner. Because if it didn't come directly from the commissioner, you're being bamboozled. All right. Good deal. Keep listening. Hold on. I got plenty more where that came from. What I want everybody to understand is that the truth about the IRS is the first tax protesters were the ones that knew that they were committing fraud. They knew the tax was never owed. But when you started using your Social Security number in commerce, you were no longer in Kansas anymore. Now, let's go back to this. Okay, so for those of you that received a notice and wasn't sure from the commissioner, let's go a little deeper. Are you sure that you're required to make such returns, render such statements, or keep such records? Which records and which statements exactly do they want you to, are you required to keep? Did you see in the third sentence where it referred to employers? Does this code section actually apply to employers? Here's my question to you. Are employers liable for taxes? If you want to know the answer to this, you ain't got to wait for me to give it to you. Just go to section 3403 under liability for tax if you want to know who's really liable for the tax. But let's go back to this section 611, because that was the next section that they cited in the notice 609 by the IRS as their right to request information. You know, 611. So 611 is talking about general requirement of return, statements or list. Now, under 611, it talks about, A, the general rule. And it says, when required by regulation prescribed by the secretary, any person made liable for any tax imposed by this title or with respect to the collections thereof, shall make a return or statement according to the forms and regulations prescribed by the secretary. Every person required to make a return or statement shall include therein the information required by such forms or regulations. I want you to go to the pertinent part of the sentence that states, any person made liable. Listen to me, family. Does this code section actually make anyone liable? Or again, does it just list consequences of being made liable, leaving the reader to assume or presume, again, that liability exists or is actually established elsewhere in the code? Neither of these code sections, 6001 nor 6011, actually establishes liability. They simply establish the consequences of being liable or being made liable. I talk to trustees and I'm doing their taxes and I'm trying to make sure that you understand being in the right position, you got to know that anything you give them, they're going to run with it because they expect you not to know the truth. See, we're going to look at the code sections to, you know, to do the state, you know, that do state that some persons are liable. You know, we're going to talk about the people that's liable. Matter of fact, we're going to go, who actually is liable? Who is actually made liable for the tax, the payment of the income tax that would trigger the filing requirements established by these sections? Okay, so let's go now to the meat and potatoes, the last section referred to by the IRS in the Notice 609 as their right to ask for information under Section 612. You remember 612? That was the last one they quoted, 612 subsection A. Well, this is what it says. Subsection 612 is dealing with persons required to make returns of income. Listen to this. In Section A, under general rule, returns with respect to income taxes under subtitle A shall be made by the following. Every individual having a taxable year gross income which equals or exceeds the exemption amount, except that a return shall be required of an individual. Number one, also those who are not married and not a spouse is not a head of the household for the taxable year has gross income less than the sum of exemption amount plus the basic standard deduction applicable to such an individual. Section two, who is actually the head of household or who is a household or for the taxable year for the gross income less than the sum of exemption amount plus the basic standard deduction applicable to such an individual. Section 3, those who is the surviving spouse for the taxable year for the gross income or has gross income of the less than the sum of the exemption amount plus the basic standard deduction applicable to such an individual. Section 4, who is entitled to make joint returns whose gross income when combined with the gross income of his spouse is for the taxable year less than the sum twice the exemption amount plus the basic standard deduction applicable to this joint return, but only if such an individual and the spouse at the close of the taxable year had the same household as their home. Bazell, no, listen to what I'm about to say. See, this section states returns with respect income taxes under subtitle A. And subsection 1A says every individual having for the taxable year. So the requirement identified here is being established for individuals under subtitle A. But where is the tax imposed on individuals that would correspond to this filing requirement? And what is the exact legal nature of the specific requirement that is established by this section 6012 in conjunction with the imposing statute? This code section 6012 may appear to be related to individuals and corresponding filing requirements for returns. But what are its legal limitations as recorded in law? And who are the individuals subject under subtitle A? Now, this next section is the money shot. This right here, if you don't listen to anything else I say tonight, you're going to find yourself in a lot of trouble. Not only with your trust res, not only with what you're doing commercially, you're going to be commingling. I'm going to sit back and just let you commingle until it's like, wait a minute. Do you understand who you are in this transaction? Because you cannot go any further until you understand the truth behind the IRS, the truth behind the income tax. Okay, let's talk about the structural organization of title. First, a short explanation regarding the organization of the tax laws in the United States Code. The IRS code that everybody is talking about, if you want to know what the Internal Revenue Code is, that's Title 26. All right, the tax law of the United States of America is in Title 26 of the United States Code. This is what's referred to as the Internal Revenue Code. Title 26 is broken into numbers of subtitles. Remember, they're saying people that are under subtitle A. Subtitle A is subject to this supposed. Okay, so Title 26 is broken into a number of subtitles, each subtitle being a distinct and separate section of law as the table below shows. Now, for those of you that can't see my screen, just listen, and you'll be able to see the video, and you'll be able to see my screen. Those of you that are looking at my screen, you know, I don't know how you're looking at my screen, but pay attention. Okay, first off, the first section that they refer to is the income taxes, and that is under subtitle A. It can be found in chapter 1 to 6, and it is in section 1. Right underneath income taxes is estate and gift taxes. Estate and gift taxes, which is under subtitle B, and that can be found in chapter 11 to chapter 13. And it can be found in sections 2001. Underneath estate and gift taxes, you now have employment taxes. Well, employment taxes fall under subtitle C, and that's under chapter 21 through 25, and that's in sections 3101. Then you have what they call miscellaneous excesses or miscellaneous excise taxes. That's found in subtitle D, and it's in chapter 31 to 47 in section 4041. Then you have alcohol, tobacco, and certain other excise taxes. That's in subtitle E, and that's in chapters 51 to 54, and it can be found in section 5001. Then underneath subtitle E, you have X tax topic, which is procedures and administration. That's found under subtitle F for Frank, and that's in chapter 61 to 80, and it's found in section, bling, 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 6001. Remember that 6001 they kept saying that you must be, you know, if you're in under procedures and administration, you're under 6001. Then underneath that, you have joint committee on taxation. Well, that's subtitle G, and that's in chapters 91 through 92 under sections 8001. Then underneath subtitle G, you have financing presidential election campaigns, which is subtitle H, and it can be found in chapters 95 to 96, and it's in sections 9001. Underneath subtitle H, you have last but not least the trust fund code. Yes, there's a trust fund code. The trust fund code is found under subtitle I, and it's in chapter 98, and it's in sections 9500. See, this book examines the laws under subtitle A that deals with the income taxes, subtitle C, which is the employment taxes, and subtitle F, procedures and administration, which applies and implements the other subtitles under the law. The code section we just looked at was 6001, 6011, and 6012, which are all from subtitle F. Income taxes are in subtitle A, consisting of chapters 1 through 6 of Title 26. Employment taxes are in subtitle C, consisting of chapters 21 through 25. It is important to understand that each subtitle establishes a direct and separate program or tax with its own individual authority to administer within that subtitle over its code sections. These authorities do not automatically cross over into other subtitles and cannot be invoked as an authority in any other subtitles unless it is shown as applicable within the law and its provisions of regulations. Each subtitle imposes its own tax and establishes the groups of persons subject to that tax within that specific subtitle. Just because one group of people is subject to one tax under one subtitle does not automatically necessarily imply that the group is automatically also subject to the taxes imposed by another subtitles. To demonstrate this point, one could ask, do you pay subtitle E taxes? For most people in this class, the answer should be a resounding no. Why not, you may ask? Isn't everybody subject to the law? Keep listening, because if you listen long enough, you will definitely, definitely learn something.
Out of darkness, here comes the brightest light. Uprising, shining so bright. Sankofa, I am my ancestor. Kushite, I am Otep. Queen Sheba. J. Garvey, Rosa Parks,
Marcus, Messiah, Garvey, Marcus, Messiah, Garvey, I'm singing both Marcus, Messiah, Garvey, Marcus, Messiah, with the blank star liner, the founder of the UNIA. He has raised the black man's kingdom, paving the way for us to go home to Mama Africa. Marcus, Messiah, Garvey, I'm singing both Marcus, Messiah, Garvey, Black Liberator. Marcus, Messiah, Garvey, Marcus, Messiah, Garvey. He told us to look to the east of the coming of a great king. Ethiopia shall stretch forth her hand unto the conquering lion. Marcus, Messiah, Garvey, Marcus, Messiah, Messiah, Garvey, Marcus, Messiah, Garvey.
All right, family. So, how to understand that the IRS is here to collect the taxes on behalf of the creditors. And it's imperative that you know exactly who you are when you're dealing with your trust res and how you're going to be interacting outside of your trust res, which we will call the general public. Part three of this is going to get very interesting, because if you don't pay subtitle E taxes, and everybody that's in this class, from my opinion, from what you relayed to me, you're not subject to subtitle E taxes. You should be collecting taxes of some sort when it comes to your estate. Now, I want you to wrap that into whatever you're doing between your real estate purchases, your disbursements for arbitration. You need to incorporate that into your fundamental load. because if you don't, you're going to be in your own way. I want to give everybody an opportunity now to ask questions. I want to use this portion of the class to address questions dealing with the COVID insurance, tax positions. I'm actually going to ask you questions on what you retain from this, because hopefully something that you've heard or listened to in this particular class will help spark and motivate you in the right direction so you won't commingle. And with that, I'll just go down the line. And remember, before I bring you on, don't be afraid to ask questions. There's no wrong or crazy or stupid questions. We're all here to learn. So if I can help anyone in that capacity, that's what I'm here to do. All right, we're going to go down the line here. Caller, last 4 digits of your number is going to be 0375. Based upon what you have listened to up until this point and what you've been able to grab, because I know it's a lot of information, it may be seeming like I'm going a million miles a minute, but I'm really going like 10 miles an hour. I'm not going as fast as I want to go. I'm just trying to get everybody's mind right. Carla, do you have any questions, comments, or concerns of anything you've heard up until this point?
Yes, I just have a general question. So since this is my very first training that I'm listening in on, is mm-hmm. there a website or a workbook out there that, because I'm more of a visual learner as well, that yeah. I could also be able to look over and read and study?
Oh, yes. I have plenty of manuals, plenty of study guides, more than you can stand. So I will definitely make sure you get that information so you can kind of follow along and kind of understand exactly where you are, especially what you're putting your trust together and things of that sort, because these things are imperative. So just off the top of your head from outside the manuals, anything that you just are inquisitive about pertaining to potential trust structures, tax structures, things of that sort, anything that comes to mind that you want to ask?
I guess maybe just a general question. This might be vague, but when you're talking about the trust, I know there's different types of trust. And so
correct.
I guess I'm a little confused when you're mentioning the trust. Is there a specific type of trust that you're talking
yes,
about, or are all these generally the same? Like when you think of a 501 or a 508, are they all handled the same way, or are we talking a specific type of trust?
Different trust. So what I'm going to do is to help everybody who may have the same question. I want you to not necessarily generalize trust, but I want you to get the basic, the fundamental aspects of trust, and then there's different variables of the fundamentals. So I'm going to give you an easy concept to wrap your brain around with trust. I want you in your mind at this moment to break trust up into two categories. You have revocable trust, and then you have irrevocable trust. And I want you to think about every time you hear the word trust, I want you to envision a box. So a revocable trust is a box that you can put things in and take things out. That's a revocable trust. An irrevocable trust is a trust that you put something in and then you put a lid on top of it. So you have a box that has a lid and you have a box without a lid. Revocable, you can put things in, take things out. Irrevocable, you put things in and you put a lid on top. Now, the type of trust that we're talking about are irrevocable trust, the type that you put something in and you put a lid on it. Now, contrary to popular demand, a lot of individuals believe that in the public, if you put assets in a irrevocable trust, you don't have access to it. Now, let me clean this up for the new people. You cannot be talking about you're a trustee in trust and not understand divestification. Like investing, put the D in front of it. Divesting. You got to divest yourself of the asset. Divestification is either going to have you enjoy this like the Rockefellers or go to prison like Al Capone. You must divest yourself of the asset. When you give it to the trust, you no longer own the asset. The asset is owned by the trust. But that does not mean you don't have control over the asset. Consumers have never really been taught about wealth from the principle of owning no thing. Say it slowly. The elite say own no thing. Control everything. You must own no thing. In order for you to be financially free, you must rid yourself of ownership. And you must embrace control. So the irrevocable trust allows you to divest yourself of the asset in order for you to control the asset. A lot of individuals say, well, Bazell, I'm not in trust and I own my car. See, I have a certificate of title. That's a certificate of title. That doesn't mean you control the car. You think you control the car? Well, go drive it on 285 without insurance, and they'll show you who controls the car. Even though you physically have it, you don't control it. I want you to think about trust in those two categories. So the type of trust that we're talking about are irrevocable trusts. Now, there are over 90 different kinds of trust. And the information I'm going to get you tonight, because we're working on your claim, we're doing your PCI, the whole 9 yards. I'm going to be up late. I think I got one of my babies that's she's on the air with us now. I ain't going to embarrass her. She's going to be helping us get this stuff done tonight. So definitely, you want to resonate with the part of the trust that gives you the most control and the ability to step out of harm's way, if that makes sense. Did it kind of help you a little bit?
Yeah, that helps a lot. And then another quick question, so because you mentioned real estate before, so if I'm doing a lot of real estate investing, how does the irrevocable trust work with real estate investing? If I want to start purchasing properties, do
beautiful.
I
beautiful. Oh, I love this question. Oh, man, y'all get ready. Y'all get your notes now. Y'all get ready. All right. If you are in real estate, the type of trust, in my opinion, and this is just Bazell's opinion, you know, it's not law. I mean, there's 90 different types of trust. You may decide you want a different type of trust. But in my experience, the preferred trust of choice when it comes to real estate is a REIT. The acronym is REIT, a REIT, which stands for Real Estate Investment Trust. It is a real estate investment trust. These trusts have a very special relationship with the Internal Revenue Service. Inside of the term sheet of most real estate investment trusts that are tied to an agency, especially in real estate, you heard of the agencies like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, right?
Yeah.
You heard of those. Okay. And then there's another agency that deals directly with HUD. So if you're filling out HUD ones, the actual agency that authorizes or has the authority over every HUD one is a Ginnie Mae. Now I'm going to give you a jewel because you made my night tonight. A lot of individuals don't realize when you have a REIT, all you need to actually acquire the property is the HUD one. I'm going to say this slowly. If you have a REIT and you complete a HUD 1, at that moment when that HUD 1 has been submitted, that's the accounting ledger that actually goes to the liquidation schedule. So with a proper REIT, you can utilize mortgage-backed security funds that are already on book and pay for the property. You don't have to go get a loan. But that does get into a lot of technical, legal mumbo-jumbo. But we have forms that you can use for that acquisition. They wrote the real estate investment trust to be what they call a REMIC, R-E-M-I-C, a REMIC, R-E-M-I-C, which stands for Real Estate Mortgage Investment conduit. And this conduit allows your feet to become a pass-through. Now, with the mortgage-backed security and your ability to create a promissory note, which is really what a mortgage is, every time you make your investment payment, this is why mortgage companies want you to make your mortgage payment between the 1st and the 15th. And yeah, there's some mortgage-backed securities that actually pay out on the 26th. Like I got one with, if we got Angie on the line, I got to talk to her because I think she has one of these trusts that actually has, well, they disperse on the 26th. We got to talk about that. But most mortgages usually want you to make your payments between the 1st and the 15th because most distribution dates for the dividends reinvestment plan are on the 16th. So technically you can't get a dividend unless you made the investment. Jenny Mae came up with the scenario that they wanted to promote home ownership through share ownership. They never wanted mortgages to foreclose. This is why if you actually had a HUD 1 and a REIT with a CUSIP tied to a mortgage-backed security and you just happen to be in the right position, you are actually funding the mortgages from an already existing mortgage pool. All of the prospectuses are only talking about the principal. There's a lot of interest that everybody's that can be utilized. Your job is, though, if you decide as a real estate investor to partake in this venture, the rule is if you pick a tranche, be prepared to buy real estate every month. Like you just can't, I'm just going to just buy just one little parcel and stop. They're going to totally kick you out of the pool because your job is to create commercial paper. The reason why I love this is because I've got my teeth cut with a company called Thurnberg Mortgage, and we used to utilize what they call pledge asset lending. So any trustee who wants to embark on PAL, they just need to say it by name, bring forth the REIT, decide on what type of Ginnie Mae they want to use, and then we can go from there. So it would be preferable in your situation, in my opinion, to use a REIT and potentially a REMIC that meets your specifications. Hope okay. I didn't say too much. Didn't say too much, did I?
Well, I have a lot to Google. So.
I got you. All right. Any other questions?
Nope. That's it for me.
Oh, okay. All right. So I'm gonna go down the line. I'm gonna see who else who's got questions pertaining to anything you've heard up until this point. All right. Let's see. Caller, last 4 digits of your number is going to be 1796. 1796. Can you hear me?
I can definitely hear you.
All right. Checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns of anything you've heard up until this point. I'm an open book. You guys caught me in a good mood, so fire away.
So. You know, I got several questions.
Okay, brother.
All right. So we're talking about real estate, acquisitions. And earlier you were talking about the HUD 1. So if, let's just say you're currently in a developing a real estate contract or you have a contract that you're actually engaged in. And now – does this HUD 1 apply for that, or how does this work? Now, I want to say this first. The actual contract is in the trust name.
Okay.
And now the first trustee has control over the actual contract. The trust agreement. Now, with that being said, is that a good thing or bad thing? That's my first question.
Okay. All right. So good thing or bad thing is all about preference. So it's a good thing if your trust is designed to collect the taxes that's owed to the estate versus a statutory trust that's subject to the laws of the land. So a good thing, bad thing kind of rests upon exactly who you are in this trust arrangement. I would say that if you have a common law irrevocable trust and you're trying to reach the pinnacle of the conversation that we just described, sounds like all you need to do is create a REIT with the ability to have those that special relationship that the IRS allows REITs to have. See, it's like if you're a REIT, the IRS kind of says it's just like having VIP status when you're in the line at the club. It's like, okay, everybody else got to stand in line and get a loan and be sacrificed, you know, in that regard. But if you have the REIT and the REMIC, you got the VIP pass. You get to skip the line, come right on in, get your drinks, enjoy what's being done. Matter of fact, they're going to buy you around. Like, they're going to give you the money first when you are a REIT and a REMIC. Because being a REIT and a REMIC keeps their game going. So they'll let you use their money. You've heard of OPM, right? You get to use OPM.
Yeah.
You know, this is why Thornburg Mortgage practices pledge asset lending. Like, they want to know what your credit score was, of course, because we couldn't just do loans and you didn't have no ability to repay. You know, but having great credit means you're a great debtor, you know. And people who understand wealth, there's good debt and there's bad debt. So we look for individuals that had that could leverage good debt, that wanted to be able to call up a broker and say, I need $8 million by tomorrow, and they were dealing with a $100 million pool, so $8 million is a drop in the bucket. That's what pledged asset lending was designed for. Now, when predatory lending took off, the guys who I work with was like, oh, we're finna take our ball and go home because this is finna be a fiasco for the real estate environment. And we want to save the savable. That's why I learned the concept save the savable. My mentors at Thornburg Mortgage told all of us, and we were in Atlanta, like they were based in California. We were in Atlanta where predatory lending and robo-signing went crazy. They told us, just bring us the savable. We're going to give them this mortgage-backed security with a dividends reinvestment plan. And they don't have to have a mortgage license to do this because they're an investor and their properties are in perpetuity. Now, that was before I knew all this stuff, what it really meant in trust. I just knew these guys had enough money where Wells Fargo, Bank of America, matter of fact, there were five institutions, major institutions, that they never did business with because it was a direct conflict against their business model. They dealt with pledged asset lending and Ginnie Mae's only. And they, when they put you into a mortgage, it never foreclosed. You made your mortgage payment of $1,000 and you got back five. Predatory lending came into play and they took their ball and they went home. And so what I didn't know is that all of the loans that we wrote, all of us that were loan officers all were part of the portfolios, and there were notaries. I didn't know anything about civil law notaries back then. I just saw this stuff being put together around me, but I was young. I was young at the time. So long and short, now that I'm older, I don't run and try to get one. I walk down and try to get them all. I'm going to suggest, from what you just explained, if you're already in a contract and the HUD one is coming, I mean, don't spook them. This is what I mean by don't spook them. The title companies and everybody that you're dealing with these contracts, they have a different agenda. They're trying to get you to sign on the line. And, buddy, when you sign, there's going to be three promissory notes that's created. They're going to tear up the original. And then the only thing that's going to be left is what's in the trust res. Remember, if you're operating in a trust, you're kind of already 80% there with becoming a REIT and using a REMIC. If you get the HUD one, and then we have a conversation about the particular QSIP that's in question, we can have a very interesting conversation. So I would say that it will be better to collect the taxes than be subject to it.
Now, in with that position, I understand what you're saying. Okay, so I'm going to give you the scenario. So what if there's a negotiation period now with what's going to be based in this trust agreement? You set your authority. You set your authority. What you have in your trust resolution.
Correct.
And the agent acting on the behalf of your trust, right? Not the first trustee, but the agent, the actual the broker that's acting on the behalf of the trust is following the trust, your first trust resolution.
Right.
Now, you made all the proper amendments to have authority over this trust agreement, and but you're not signing on the dotted line as the person, as your person, or as the trustee. Do you sign on the behalf of the trust, or you sign the trust name, or do you sign
authorized representative? Authorized representative.
So you sign UCC UCC 1-308.
You can use 308, but you want to, as far as title, you want to sign it as authorized representative.
All right, so that spelling and everything, authorized representative.
Right, you'll say John Doe, authorized representative, UCC 1-308.
Okay. Now, let's go through the process.
Okay.
So, does the actual? Let me go back to my questions. All right. Because I got my notes too.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, with this being said, formulate your trust as a REIT, right? That's the first thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All right. And what if you already have your trust resolution already in place for real estate?
Right. So let me give you kind of. So you don't overcomplicate it and you take the pressure off yourself.
Okay.
Any contract can be treated as a trust. So if you have a business trust that's making this acquisition and you just learned this information tonight, you can construct an agreement which will allow the business trust to function as a REIT. And then you incorporate the variables that make the benefits of a REIT applicable to your trust. Like I want you to, if you go back to what I was reading about the truth about the income tax, you got to understand that they made you applicable because they took bits and pieces of other subtitles and just threw them on you and you never questioned them. You just volunteered the information. Now I'm going to reverse engineer this. All you have to do in your trust is pick bits and pieces that compel them to act the way you need them to act in your relationship. As the trustee or settlor, no one can tell you how to contract. They have to protect your ability to contract your way, unlimited, unmolested. So when we're talking about a REIT, I'm going to go down the rabbit hole just for a few seconds, so just bear with me. I would approach this purchase as a pledge asset lending structure. I would go through my contract that requires me to do anything with other than lawful legal money. I wouldn't even talk about earnest money or all those things because if I'm going to give earnest money, I need to see your CTR. So I would simply have this done as a pledge asset lending structure where I show you my assets over here that we're going to use for this acquisition. And then I'm going to point you to a security that has the liquidity that you need. But we can't exchange like Chris Tuck and Friday. I got to do it at the same time. You got to bring me what I need. So when we make the exchange, I'm walking away with exactly what I need and you have exactly what you are needing because I know the game you're going to play with anything that I give you. I am not allowed to play in your game. If you're a beneficiary of this trust, then you're going to get the same instruction that I just said. It's just going to be in a different format. Same result. We're never going to exchange where it's not quid pro quo. And quid pro quo is something for something of equal exchange. If you are given Federal Reserve notes on Monday and you aren't closing on your loan until 30 days from now, is the money you got on Monday, does it have the same value 30 days from now?
No.
No.
Okay. So 99.9% of the individuals that are not in a trust structure have no contextual, and I'm not calling everybody stupid. We are emotionally correct, commercially wrong. Our concept of money is so off base that we will, listen to this, the Federal Reserve note is a promissory note that nobody's paying. Now, the only reason why you accept Federal Reserve notes is because that's what you're used to, and you know you can always give it to someone else. As the trustee, you no longer have that luxury. Throw that thinking away. It's going to hurt you. If I get Federal Reserve notes, it has to be given to not me directly, but to the institution that can hold it. I don't actually need to have it, long as I have access to it, long as I can give documentation to an agent to carry out the acquisition. I'm going to tie it all in with your agent. Your agent needs to have immunity and the ability to arbitrarily utilize and leverage your lawful legal money. And you want to structure this as a pledge asset lending structure if you're going to use a REIT and a CUSIP with a mortgage-backed security. Because now the deal is in reverse. If you go and you got to apply for a mortgage, you got to go get on the chopping block and sacrifice yourself. And then they're going to come back. Notice you're giving them everything. They're going to take your information, go to the DTC, see what you're really worth, and then they're going to try you. Like, let's see if he really know what he's doing. Okay. All right. Well, we ran your credit and we decided you don't quite meet our requirements. That's a test. Listen to what I'm about to say, because I work both sides of the fence. 99% of the people who get denied loans, you actually make money for the company and they ain't had to give you nothing. Because when you gave them those contracts, just like they pull your credit, they ran your stuff all through the system. And those little teeny tiny prints, you waive your right. Everybody going to use you like a joint. And they didn't have to give you nothing. You remember in the 90s, where if you could go to three places that would deny you credit, you automatically got credit on the fourth try? Y'all remember that? Gotta remember that.
Yep.
You don't remember that in the 90s? Like, we're going to back up. Like, we're going to go to the 2009 real estate fiasco.
Yeah, they did the 80-20.
Right. I did loans where if you showed me three denials, you automatically was approved.
Yep.
I asked you for, all right, who denied your credit? I went to Bank of America, Wells Fargo, WaMu. All right, great. Sign right here. They closed on Friday. That's what the robo-signing stuff, though. anyhow. I know you got some more questions for me. I'm trying to get you to get me across the scary line where I don't get you in trouble, but I think I know where you're going with this. So keep going. I know you got some more questions.
So the conversation that was had, and I read about the immunity portion. Okay. And I think we got echoes.
Could be some echoes coming in. Go ahead.
Okay. So if the agent, the immunity portion of the agent, that's the immunity from the state that they're actually governed under with their license.
There you go. Right.
And then the functionality that they have under that license. Now they step away from that license and the state that they're governed under, and they function, they come in my arena and function
right
in my trust resolution.
Right, with immunity.
So,
right.
With that being said, in my trust resolution, I get to amend this trust agreement that I'm embarking upon, right? And we talk about a three. We talk about in 3 days once terms are met, right? With this agreement. Now with this earnest money, that they requested that I didn't agree to, right? If I haven't signed the document yet. Okay, in my terms, I actually take my representative, not agent, not acting agent, real estate agent of, let's just say Texas. Right. I take this agent, and I let him know we are going to utilize lawful legal money in this transaction, and I need you to relay this to the title company.
Right. Okay. Right? So you want to kind of know how that would look,
what document and how that will look.
Let's make it real simple. The settler of the trust simply states that in order for this transaction to meet current expected credit loss provisions, in order for us to convey any monies to any account, those account holders must provide the last 90 days CTRs. If you cannot produce the last 90 days CTRs, then all earnest monies will be waived in lieu of lawful legal money being used to facilitate the purchase. Don't step into a liability that you don't have to when they are not in compliance, because he who signs is liable.
Yep.
Everything is a tax.
Yep.
See, so, let me show you that. Go ahead. I was going to give you one more to go with this, because there's a reason why I always go to the CTRs for the other side. If they can show you the CTRs, then you can liquidate the CTR and they got their earnest money. This is why I asked for that. Operating circular says that if you are participating in these type of transactions and you're the fiduciary, you have to exercise your fiduciary powers. Well, as a notary, can't you monetize a negotiable instrument with a signature medallion guarantee stamp? The actual currency transaction report becomes a negotiable instrument. If you actually read the CTR, they have a section on there for negotiable instruments. The actual application itself can become a negotiable instrument in the hands of a knowledgeable trustee, because the section of the CTR where it says, list the financial institution upon where the transaction took place. Well, trustee, you're the bank. So what part of that application you probably be filling out on your end? You will be filling out the financial institution side, because you are the FICO score. You are the bank.
Wow.
You have to understand, it's not about who they're dealing with. They're dealing with chartered banks. You are a non-banking bank. You're a trustee.
So now, all right. So what we've been using the actual bank as our agent when we can utilize
right.
You're getting it.
Right, because you're the fiduciary.
That's where our FICO. That's where the FICO comes in. That we're utilizing.
Right.
You know our trust.
Right. Right. Remember, when you look up, when you enter that number into a certain database, you see all these companies that are using that number. And you can use it, too, as a fiduciary. It's just for your trust benefits now, not for theirs.
Oh, my gosh. So we've been looking at contracts and looking at lenders and borrowers the wrong way.
Right, but that's by design, because they want you looking at it that way. Because, remember, the fiat is what? Not backed by nothing anymore. They want you looking at it this way, because if you really apply the real math, you're like, why am I dealing with form and no substance? I can just simply get some gold and silver, let my mom hold it, who don't go nowhere and do nothing in the public, and I can just tend to paper all day. I'm the fiduciary. She don't like dealing in the public. Let me give you a secret.
The bank, you just, all right, so hold on one second. Hold on. So this same entity that you wrote as your lender, let's just say I'm going with Wells Fargo. Mm-hmm. The same entity that you wrote as your lender, he goes back and reviews the information that you put in, you know, with your Social Security number, let's say. And he takes it to underwriting. Underwriting actually sends it back, and they actually fund a project or home or whatever with your Social Security number, not with your tax ID number.
Right. Banks don't have any money to lend. People are under the illusion banks don't have no money. Give them money. The Federal Reserve lends them money. The banks don't have no money. You think banks let me show you how the banks work. When you deposit your money, you deposit $1,000 into the bank. They get to create $9,000 out of thin air. The Federal Reserve prints this money. It only costs them 0.3 cent to print a sheet of $100 bills. That's why a dollar is only worth 0.3 cent. This is why if you got $1 million in your bank account, you only got $30,000 of buying power. Now, what if you don't got $1 million in your bank account? Well, you're at a negative. Y'all ain't figured that out yet. Like, if you don't have $1 million in Federal Reserve notes, you barely got 30 grand of buying power. So what if you got 30 grand in your bank account? You're at a negative. What if you got 100 grand? You're at a negative. What if I got 250? Well, at least at 250, you're almost at zero. That's why the insurance started at $250,000. They know what the game is. You don't.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I read and I gave everybody TLIC because thanks to our guy Musa, who former banker of Wells Fargo, he blessed all of us with that TLIC document where they admitted to the fact that all banks have sold account holders out because they created a trust authority called the Orderly Liquidation Authority that now is running the banks. And the banks get to file bankruptcy, but they make you pay for it because you've been the creditor the whole while under the Dodd-Frank Act and you never did the accounting. That's why current expected credit losses is so severe and banks don't want to become CECL compliant because if they do, they got to pay back the tax. The whole while we've been in this class and we talked about the truth of the income tax, you know who actually represents that subtitle that's in question, you know, that subtitle of who's supposed to be paying taxes and who not? Like subtitle E?
Mm-hmm.
Subtitle E, and the reason why none of you guys are under subtitle E is because subtitle E deals with the manufacture of the sale of alcohol and tobacco and firearms. So unless you are engaged into alcohol, firearms and tobacco, this whole income tax thing, you volunteered for it. And because you use the Social Security number, you have sealed your fate. I only got 60 seconds left. I appreciate everybody tuning in. I'm going to go one more hour. But if you're not called in by now, you're going to have to just listen to it on the replay because we are now in overtime. But that's the whole deal, brother. Because you use the remember the Social Security Administration said don't use that number in commerce, period. Because the whole thing is not, the taxes are voluntary. The only individuals that are subject to the taxes are those that manufacture and sell alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. So
okay.
When I don't hear your trust res manufacturing alcohol, firearms, or tobacco, I have the same response. Why do you want to pay a tax when you can collect the tax? Now, if you want to pay the tax, then you're using the social. So please understand, you got to get in line now. Because if you want to pay the taxes, All these other companies have already milked the Social Security Trust. You're the only one that's in the back of the line. Like, there ain't going to be no more milk left when you get up there. It's going to be gone. Like, the Social Security Administration is broke. They have no intentions on paying. If I reach retirement tomorrow, they're going to take your money, your wife's money, and everybody else on this line's money, give it to me, and pray the next man don't make it. That's how it works. Maybe that's why they introduced COVID. They're not the herd. I'm just saying.
That's right. So let me give you this. Let me see
okay.
what I have right here. That to give you a sense of where I know where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in this document with this agent's with the agent's information, right?
Right.
It speaks about their position.
Mm-hmm.
I want to read the proper terms. Give me one
mm-hmm.
second.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about their representation for you.
Right.
All right. All right. Broker is not really inspector. Okay. Gosh, I'm trying to get it without disturbing your the class.
I got you, brother. Well, I tell you what, if you want, because I know it's a couple folks that want to get some questions in, I'll come back to you. I'll let you find it, and then I'll go down the line, come back in, because everybody that's in now, unfortunately, I can't take any more call-ins because we're in overtime right now. So unless you're online, they can't call in now. So I'll let you find what you're looking for, and then I'll go down the line and come back, bro. I'll come back.
Gotcha. All right.
All righty. All right. Okay, let's go down the line. Oh, it's getting good now. Call the last four digits of your number, 0469. 0469. I'm checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns over anything you heard at this point or anything relevant to dealing with the income tax, COVID insurance. What's on your mind? Hey, you got my attention.
Bae, I'm just listening. You can go to the next
okay.
caller. This is Will.
Okay. Are you learning anything, big bro?
Yes, sir.
All right. All right. That's what I want to hear. That's what I want to hear. All right. Well, let me go down. All right. Let's go down the line to last four digits of the number. It's going to be 4513. 4513. I'm checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns over anything you've heard up until this point, or just any general questions, you know, pertaining to any of the information you might have seen previously.
Just one quick question, because I came in on the tail end of this conversation when you were talking about the preferred choice of the real estate investment trust. When you were talking
right.
about the lending aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
I think you were saying something about were you saying that you automatically get approved for the money or when you go
okay,
get
let's,
as far
okay,
as
let's
purposes?
Back up. Like, yeah, like let me give you like back in the day, with predatory lending being at the peak in the robo signing, there was a program with the 80-20 lending program where if you got three denials, you automatically qualify for a lending package because you got three denials. But no one asked the question, well, why do I get the approval? People didn't care why they was approved. They didn't understand the mechanism behind it. And the reason why is because, okay, having great credit in the conventional mind state means you're a great debtor. You know, having good credit, the better your credit, the less money they make off of you. Having credit in the toilet, they get to charge you out the yin-yang because what? Your credit ain't as good as everybody with a 700 and 800 score. So there was an incentive by certain banks that I'm not going to call their names anymore, but they would, if you wasn't part of the nuclear family protocol, if you don't know what a nuclear family is, married, wife, both of you guys stay in the same household with two kids and a white picket fence and a dog, if you wasn't the nuclear family, you were denied. So if you were denied, then those institutions that would service those non-nuclear families get to charge higher interest rates. So they were purposely, listen to this, a bank that's formerly known as the Gangsters Bank would literally, you know how gangsters work, right? Like a gangster show up to your place of business and says, I think by Friday you need to purchase fire insurance. And you're like, well, I already got fire insurance. Like, no, I think you need to purchase some more insurance. You know, last week, Bob's shop burned down. And you're like, okay, well, that's good information. Then 2 days later, the shop next to yours catches on fire. And they show back up. Like, you need to buy some insurance by Friday. Well, it was a bank that operated like that. They used to call themselves the Gangsters Bank. We'll go into that a little later. Anyhow, they would literally, they were setting all the houses on fire in the neighborhood. Let me say it that way. And he was forced to get their product. So you would come in the door and they would deny you credit so they can send you around the corner to charge you extra interest. And I just happened to be a loan officer in that whole flip. So all I had to do was you came in and showed me three denials and you were automatically approved. But I worked with underwriting. I understood why they was doing what they were doing. That's what you was hearing the tail end of that.
Okay.
And so then, do you
I
have
guess
any...
my other question is when you talked mm-hmm. when you talked about the recoverable trust, where you can
right.
put things in and you could put things and take things out, right? And then the
right.
Irrevocable. All right. So is it two trusts that you're setting up or is it one trust that you're setting up?
Okay.
Is it two different types
of trusts
you're setting
up? I want you to get into
up?
Your head. Yeah, like I want you to – so I love this type of question. So check with the new folks so they can really, you know, expand their mind. Actually, when you hear the word trust, I want you to associate the word trust with three different types of trust. Three trusts. Now, you may initiate starting out with one, but you want to at least have three trusts when you're talking about trust. Now, I'm going to explain this in a way where it don't get you in trouble. We're going to say that you're going to start a family trust, a business trust, and a charitable trust. And we're going to say that you're going to pour $100,000 in assets into this trust structure. Now, how I'm going to explain this is going to show you how you get 100% use of the 100 grand tax-free, and you're going to have more than 100 grand when you follow these instructions. 100% use, zero tax liability, and at the end of the transaction, you're going to have more assets than what you started. So envision in your mind, I'm starting with $100,000. Now,
okay.
before you think about this $100,000, now you probably think about $100,000 cash. Let me be real clear with a trust. A $100,000 life insurance policy can fund your trust. If you have a business that has $1 million commercial insurance policy, that can fund your trust. These are what we call general intangibles. So don't get boxed in to I got to have a rich uncle or I hit the lottery and I got $100,000 cash. Follow me?
Yep, I'm following.
Okay, all right. Now, you pour the $100,000 into your business trust first. And then, what's half of $100,000? $50,000, right?
$50,000.
All right. So you spend or you utilize in your business $50,000. And then you transfer the other $50,000 from your business trust to your family trust. Now you got $50,000. What's half of $50,000?
$25,000.
So the family trust will utilize the $25,000, and then it will send the other $25,000 to the charitable trust. Here's where the magic takes place. If you use that $25,000 in a charitable trust, there's some magic that happens with the charitable trust because the charitable trust actually makes money by giving it away. So if you contribute $25K to the charitable trust, the charitable trust gets to enjoy let me scale it down because I don't want to blow your mind. Under anything that's under $1 million, you will be able to turn a $25,000 endowment to $250,000 in that trust. So let's do the math. You got 100% use of $100,000, and you actually made an additional $150,000. And it was all tax-free, and you deferred it from trust to trust to trust, because this is called arm's distance deal. Uh-huh. So when you talk about trust, you want to envision utilizing more than one trust to have control over the general intangible asset. These three trusts are going to work together as one. But mechanically, it's going to be three separate trusts operating together. Business trust, family trust, and charitable trust. There are over 90 different kinds of trust. And as you get into the different kinds, they have different Superman super abilities, if that makes sense. You know, you got to research the different types to know which ability you want to make applicable. But for conversation purposes, this is 100% tax-free, tax-deferred, and you actually end up with more than what you started with. How much did you start out with in this initial structure?
$100,000.
Okay. And then at the end of it, you ended up with $250,000. So what kind of return was that on your investment? Over 100% rate of return, right.
100%, over 100.
Right. So when trustees talk about getting 100% rate of return, they're not lying. They just know something that most don't. Not hard. See, the bank won't even give you 2% rate of return. And if you just simply took control of your situation, you can get 100%. You. Not you investing in the crypto, even though I love crypto. This is just trustee training 101. Remember, you funded your trust with insurance policy, right? So how much fiat did it cost?
Nothing.
Any other questions, Big Bro?
No. Wow. I'm literally just that part about setting up the family trust, the business trust, and the charitable trust. I'm like blown away. I'm gonna be up all night, right? Just like she said earlier about Googling stuff, be up all night Googling stuff.
Right, right. But then look, we're here to learn, brother. We're here to learn. We are here to learn. So that's what it is. But hey, if you don't have any other questions, I'll circle back before we jump off. I'll come back.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Okay, let's go down the line. Caller, last four digits of your number is going to be 4630. I'm checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns over anything you heard up until this point or anything in general. What did we discuss, you know, previously?
Yes. So, okay. First off, let me just kind of start here.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, these are some really great questions, some things that I haven't thought of to put some stuff together for me. So thank you guys for the great questions. But initially, when you stated prior to asking the questions, you said something, and I was kind of in and out, and I think I missed the point. But I heard the final part when you stated that something about getting in your own way. And I know it was something about tying in the tax
right.
class that you just had
mm-hmm.
into, I guess, the transactions or something. Can you kind of repeat that and kind of go over that again?
Right. Okay. So here's what it is. The truth about the income tax is individuals that are subject to the tax, most volunteer to be subject to it. And because you became subject to a tax that you never owed, they had to put something else around your neck to keep you in place. you know, like they tell you, how do you train an elephant? Well, here's how you train an elephant. You find the biggest rope you can find, and you tie it to an elephant, and you tie it to the biggest tree you can find. And then when the elephant tries to break the rope, everybody in the village comes out, and they beat the elephant within an inch of his life until he mentally conditions himself that he's not going to try to flee. Then you take the rope off his neck, and you put a string, and he'll never break the string. This is what has happened to most of us. You actually can leave the plantation tonight, mentally. But every time you think about leaving, something is coming out beating you within an inch of your life commercially, to the point where the only thing that's holding you is a piece of paper. A piece of paper that, I want you to think about it. There are men and women on death row being held at gunpoint by guards and risking their life because of paperwork. Matter of fact, the same people that are sitting on death row, they were sentenced by the state. When they take you down the hall to death row and put you into the either the electric chair if you're dealing with Georgia and old Sparky, but lethal injection, you're going to be stuck by a physician or electrocuted by a commissioner who's licensed by the state. The preacher who's going to be preaching your eulogy probably was licensed by the state. These are the same individuals that when they had to release Christ versus Barbarus, they rather release the prisoner than release the Savior, and he too was prosecuted by the state. You're in a situation where the state has no problem because you don't get with the program. They got a plan for you. They've taught it to you all your life. The truth about the income tax is that was, okay, you're the elephant that can leave. They put the rope on you with the tax that didn't apply. And you know it didn't apply, so you was breaking the rope. But every time you broke the rope, they came out from every corner and they beat you within an inch of your life financially until you mentally gave up. They don't have a rope around your neck. They got a piece of string. And it's not a good piece of string. It's that cheap string. You know, it's not, it ain't, it's really flimsy. It's just we're afraid. The IRS, you shouldn't fear them because the IRS is your best friend. They're your business partner. They collect taxes. Look, if you are Moorish, this is what I mean by you being in your own way. I have a very different conversation with Moors dealing with taxes. I talk to everybody like this because I don't know what your nationality is, so I'm just kind of, you know, I'm in the middle of the road here. But if you're saying, well, Brazil, I'm this and that, and then now I'm looking at you like, all right, why you ain't broke the string? Hell, took the rope and hung one of them. What are you doing? That's what I mean by being in your own way. Because the first tax protesters were the judges. Look, they booked on a 3% tax. I want you to think about this for a second. The United States Supreme Court judges know that the whole tax game is a sham. That's why going to court is what? What y'all always hear me say about going to court in the public? What is that when you go to court in the public? That's tax
a
what?
A tax matter. A tax
it's
matter?
It's tax fraud.
Oh, tax fraud. Okay.
It's fraud. Look, you're not... Let me let you know that everything that if you know, there's a doctrine in law called fruits of a poisonous tree. The whole court system is built upon the fact that everything in commerce is a tax, and the only people that are subject to the tax is those that what? Manufacturing alcohol, tobacco, and dealing with firearms. Now, again, like we have a television show back in Georgia. It might be all over the world at one point. It used to be a show back in the day in the 80s called The Dukes of Hazzard. Y'all remember the Duke boys, right? Good old Uncle Jesse and the General Lee and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the first episode of the Duke Boys
was they got out the first episode on probation, not to make moonshine again. But what did they do in the very first episode? Well, damn it, they was making moonshine all
moonshine
7 days.
All day.
Right. Well, they was running, you know, because it was all on the tape. Look, in the
right.
80s, you understood what the taxes was for and who it was for. People in the South was like, fuck that. I can make my own alcohol and I can drive it down to Tennessee. I got a General Lee with a 455 in it. What you finna do? It's
right.
Like, hey,
catch me if you can. I'm just
right. And if the local police was in, like, I'm gonna go here today in the prison system. You know how most cigarettes get inside the prison?
The correctional officer.
The CO, because they make more money bringing that contraband in than what the state is paying them. So, it's a system. That's what I mean by you're in your own way. And you have to get the truth so you can free yourself. Because every family member that has been tagged with that Social Security number, they're being monetized. Whether you wake up or go back to sleep, they are not stopping that money train. They will kill you in the process if you wake up and get off the plantation and you take 100 people with you. Yeah, they're going to look for you. Now, if all 100 get off the plantation at the same time and do their own thing, that's too much. You know, it's easy for them to go back and get the other 100 that's going to replace them. Because remember, people are being born and they're dying every day. Remember?
Uh-huh.
If you get out the plantation, they're not really worried about you. They're worried about who you finna go tell.
I was right. Sitting in the office with the fake tax collectors, and they asked us how many people are in your group, or where did you get this information from? How many people are in your group? How many people did you tell?
Right. That's what they're concerned with.
Right. They don't want you to get the information out.
Right. I'm going to put it all the way out there because you brought it up. If I'm doing this privately, I'm not going to have 500 subscribers. I'm going to have 5, 10. Because
mm-hmm.
what? It's private. I don't need 500 people. I just need a few good men and women. Everybody want to be a part of a good thing, but it's not meant for everybody. Everybody ain't cut to be a trustee. It just is. It sound good.
So when you were saying, speaking of kind of like everybody's not meant to be a trustee of that, I guess, of that sort, when you said earlier that I guess you were talking to the gentleman in regards to the trust purchasing property with
right.
the payment and things of that nature. And you made
right.
a statement about the signature. I understood when you were like, okay, you can sign it as authorized representative. But when you went into, you made a statement about being the one who signs the one that's liable. I thought
right.
as the trustee and or fiduciary or creditor, you wanted to be the one liable because that goes back into public and the private examples that you gave. Because
right.
if you are, what is it called? I want to say liability free, but that's not what it said, what the example was. But it was kind of like that list of things that creditors do and things that debtors do.
Right.
Right. So when, as a creditor, don't you want to be the one liable? Because at that point,
you want to be the one liable when you're going to be relying on public funds. But the REIT has a special relationship with the IRS where they get to be treated like a pass-through security, and the REMIC is the conduit. So kind of think about it like this. If you are the conduit between the purchaser and the seller, like you're the wire that everything travels upon. Does the wire benefit from both the purchaser and seller, even though they're the conduit between the two? Like, they benefit because the energy flows, what, through them. doesn't belong to them. It just flows through them. Don't you think if you're the conduit, a couple of that extra energy that's initially put in, you don't get to kind of what? Use it? Remember, it's got to flow through you. It's like, so you're benefiting just by being the conveyance between the two parties. So there's a special relationship with the REIT. The REITs don't have to go get loans. The REITs use money that's already in the mortgage pool. It's called notional pooling. But you, that's not a trustee, that's a 14th Amendment citizen, don't you dare talk about notional pooling because they finna come see you because you're not allowed to do it. Mm-hmm. There's only a few agencies that can, and the REIT is happen to be one of them.
Okay.
Now, there's another.
Right.
So the REIT, the real estate game is older than the stock market. So they got an older track record. So they got grandfathered into this whole debt securitization because they already had their own game with the mortgages and the treaties and the land patents and all this other stuff. So the REITs, if you start a REIT, you don't have to go get lending. You just got to agree to do pledge asset lending to the person who is opposite of the trust. Like, pledge us your assets, and then we will lend the value. Notice how I said
that. So when you say pledge asset lending, that's more or less like promissory notes?
You bring your insurances, your melanin, your young, your old, and we will go and monetize that for you, grasshopper.
Oh, okay.
Because
so we just come up with it. We bring the instrument to the table, and
you
then
bring the,
that's
you bring
that's
the substance. Right. That's why when everybody was doing all this crazy predatory lending, my group packed up and went to Mexico. They literally—I'm not being funny. They literally went to Mexico. They're like, you ain't got to go home, but you got to get out of here because we're done, son. This is over. Because
Georgia ripped them a new one. Georgia is just whew.
Yeah, you know. So you know, shout out to Countrywide
okay,
and Internet.
So right, right. So now, when you use that as an example, as so in that as it's more or less in my mind at this point, kind of like knowing when to be the trustee, when to be the fiduciary, when to be the beneficiary. So
right.
Kind of the same thing, knowing when to be the creditor and knowing when to be just the authorized representative or just the trustee of
you just gotta know when to hold them, when to fold them, know when to walk away, know when to run.
So I think my last question in this aspect is I'm still having a problem connecting the taxing with the PCI claim.
Okay.
So, and I remember earlier you said it doesn't have to be the, you don't have to do the tax thing with, and I guess it's because for me as a tax preparer, I've pulled myself out of doing taxes for the SSN and strictly for the trust or estate. Like most of the utilities that I deal with are in the estate name. They're not even in the government name. So it's kind of like, am I still bound to that at this point? Or because it's something that I'm not saying I'm never doing this, but it's just something I kind of put on the back burner to get through the PCI portion of it. So,
okay. So the private COVID insurance is a niche insurance because everyone that's been labeled, tagged, vaccinated, or potentially going to be labeled, tagged, and vaccinated, in our eyes, meaning those of us that are under Diversity Holdings Limited that make up the underwriting proponent of that insurance, we look at COVID patients, potential patients, or victims who've been exposed, had it, and so forth, as the same type of victims that went through World War One. Nazi war camp, you were exposed to a biological weapon that you could not get away from. So what can we do shy of sending a helicopter to rescue you and your family? Well, we can provide something financially to allow you to transition out of harm's way. Now, all we need is an excuse, a medical incentive in order for us to incentivize and indemnify your reasoning for transitioning from this political status, which has you a dead legus, into a sentient, living, breathing soul where you can live off the land in perpetuity. I'm not doing this for fame or money. Matter of fact, I got some strange phone calls, which I knew I was going to get because we're in the COVID space. But this goes with the territory. They can't scare me. They can't stop me. All they can do is try to do that. But again, if they do something to me, there'll be someone else to take my place, so I'm not worried about that. At the end of the day, this is what's needed because they've already let the cat out of the bag that they have already deemed corona, the coronavirus. They're going to call it a corona disease, and you're going to be able to file Social Security benefits for that. Well, we don't have time to pay the retirement when they're going to kill you off with the biological weapon. What good is having the disability if you're dead and you can't use it? They got a plan. And so what's your plan? Like, okay, the banks left the building under TILIC in 2016. In 2019, they was called to the stand. And the biggest violator, which is Wells Fargo, I don't have anything personal against Wells Fargo, but I got to catch you up on why the tax and COVID all work together. These 30-plus CEOs who all stepped down before the major initial lockdown all knew that they don't want to be CEOs when Wells Fargo take the stand. Y'all ain't figured out why. Well, when you do an administrative process, you know who knows how to tender this stuff through the system? The CEOs and the CFOs. All those vouchers you've been sending in, they've been troubling dipping with the IRS. They got 1099 OIDs. They got old money. You know, they got money. The money they're spending was money they got 3 years ago before COVID. You know, you're worried about Sleepy Creepy Joe giving you a stimulus. And if you keep waiting on that, good luck with that. I'm just like, you know, if Joe has not cut your check yet, keep waiting. I'm waiting for Joe to say, if you want to get a check, go get a jab. That's what I'm waiting on that. When he do that, then again, I'm going to pull out my T-shirt and say, remember, y'all voted for this bullshit. For everybody, don't – look, you voted for him, so don't run now. Remember, y'all, you know, this guy has been in the White House over 40 years. I'm over 40 years old. I remember when his hair was black.
So, I remember when he was him.
Right.
When he wasn't a robot.
Right. So I'm saying, like, how can the guy who always has done this BS be the solution that you expect something different? He can't. They don't,
right.
I'm going to say this again. They don't change their behavior. They change the rule. So I done heard him say some stuff that I almost find hilarious. It's not funny because it's affecting my grandbaby. So I have to laugh to myself and get focused. And right now,
it's funny. And I ain't trying to be funny, but Ice Cube told y'all, get something for your vote this time, because it ain't gonna go like you think it is.
Right.
And I'm not a voter, so it doesn't matter. I don't have a dog in this hunt. But at the end of the day,
I don't have a dog in the fight. And until I understand that we are sitting where they've already called this election a fraud and a sham, I'm still waiting for the final investigation of these. Now, you know, there's a lot of physicians, politicians, everybody, you know, like, all right, and I'm not going to get too far off subject. But there's a group of people who are coming forth that have said some stuff. That's why I said I got a strange call. we all have a certain level of information, but we're not allowed to release it because it could be detrimental to one's health. It's out there, and they've scrubbed the internet of it. But there's so much that has happened in the last year, a lot of our people have forgotten it. But if this pandemic is what they say it is, everybody use some common sense. This disease is so deadly that you gotta take a test to know you have it. No, not you got symptoms. You got to go take a test. And they told you that if you got vaccinated, you don't have to worry about the corona. But unfortunately, since you're getting jabbed, really, if you get the jab, that doesn't mean you ain't going to get it. Well, what the hell is the jab about? So let me get this right. You want me to take a vaccine so safe that I got to be threatened to take it against a disease so deadly, I got to take a test to know I got it. And you can stand on my roof and piss on me, and that's rain. You know, so now if I'm on that mental level, and I'm not being cynical, if I've been that dumbed down where I can't see exactly what's happening, what they're doing with the income tax is like, okay, we're going to bring in the digital currency. We're going to ask you a few questions. And it's the elephant. Remember, the elephant can break the rope and leave. It just when he starts, like, they don't jump on the elephant after he gets off the rope. You know why? Because now they got to deal with him. That rope is restricting him. He can break it, but he's concentrating on the rope. If the elephant knew, damn the rope, damn the tree. Hell, I'm going to use the rope with the tree. How about that? Y'all, come on, I got something for you. You know,
right, I'm with your ass.
Right, like in prison when I would see guys that was getting ready to get jumped on by the goon squad, the most dangerous thing you can do with an inmate is in his confined space, it's a bottleneck. Now, y'all might be 30 deep, but you got to come in that one door. I already got the high ground. When I put that stuff on that floor, I put that baby oil on that floor, I'm finna give you the business. I promise you, when I get done with about 10 of them, the other 20 going to think differently. You might get the taser, but you ain't finna come up in here. You got to understand that you got to use what is around you. We just been conditioned that we want a man in the cloud to do it. You know, somebody else's job. This thing with trusteeship is like, no. Right. They have literally given you everything you need to get out of harm's way. And this COVID thing is a precursor for you to use to get off the plantation. We just need for you to look at it from the point of view that it's a direct violation of the Nuremberg Code, because the IRS tax code for paying the tax, listen to how I'm saying this. I want you to really, if paying the tax only applies to subtitle, what is it again? Because you got me excited. Subtitle E. The only people that are probably paying taxes, those that are under subtitle E. Well, guess who gets to collect the taxes? Everybody else who is competent, who is a sentient soul, who actually is owed a tributary tax. You have a right to collect that tax. These people who have stolen your birthright, they're wearing fezes, they saying Al-Salam, Al-Salaikum, and all that other stuff, while in secret, pretending not to know who you is. And then they laugh secretly when you show up with a driver's license with a slave name. Like, he don't even know. He using my granddaddy name. Okay. You know, and they got to keep a straight face when they do it now. So we got to understand that our history was handed to us by them. how good do you think that investigation went? They gave you Jesus, your education, and your money system. How good do you think that investigation is going to go?
It's not going to go well. My thing is in the etymology and the spelling of the word, it says his story. That's his story.
Right. And you know, what about your story? Your story is a mystery to you.
Mystery, right. It's a mystery.
My story is a mystery to me. Story, you're going to beat me over the head until I learn that. You know what?
Until I learn his lie.
Right. I got to learn it because that's how they're going to trick me and keep me. Look, you took the rope off your neck, you got a string, and you ain't even bucking no more. You just want to be left alone. Like, I hear it all the time. I just want to be left alone. Like, do you think compliance help? You know, like, are they messing with people who are actually doing stuff or not really doing stuff? I just read, somebody sent me an arbitration case. I'm not going to put their business out there. I got a young lady right now that's got a life sentence for less than an ounce of marijuana in New Orleans. A life sentence. She's 23 years old. They gave this woman life for less than an ounce.
Isn't that supposed to be off the books now? They're not supposed to be doing that anymore.
Look here. Bill Gates and Ellen DeGeneres, they're promoting municipal gummies on television, but they gave this 23-year-old melanated woman life. Now, I'm not going to be quiet about that. And it's like, no, it's like, come on, man. Wake up. Slavery, this IRS code, and I'm going to end the class with this. I'm going to go back to my guy because I think he's going to go into the real estate thing. The income tax is a slave tax. And when I finished all parts of this series on the truth of the income tax, you're going to know it. Because you have to know it. The judges knew it. That's why the judges didn't want to be slaves. That's why they bucked on the 3%. And they still uphold it. Now, the Supreme Court judges cannot be subject to the tax and don't want to be slaves. I'm just saying. So that's what I meant by being
in
your
own. The offices of the court. Or
right.
Of
right.
The federal government and as notaries were officers.
Right.
Okay.
That's why I said in your under your commission, you can't be subject to the tax. There's a method to my madness. I want you to become notary so you have the legal excuse to free your family.
Then,
I don't need your whole family being notaries. If you got one conscious person in your family that's a civil law notary, everybody can bring their business to them.
So now this is my last question because I know you need to get back to the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say I'm a notary,
right,
and I'm not a civil law notary. I'm just new to the platform.
Right.
And I am looking to relieve not just my family, but me first. You know, I'm going to put my face mask
right
on first.
Right.
So what does that look like coming out of that particular, like when I'm the elephant and I got the string, I'm about to pop the string. So as
right
they're trying to beat me, I'm trying to stomp on somebody. What does that look like on this side of the fence? Am I rescinding signatures? Am I just pulling codes and saying, hey, at the end of the day, this is what this says? Because I don't even know what book you were reading from. Because
I'm going to make it available. Right. I'm going to send this book out. But what I've learned, because I recently was under another this is another thing, too. I've already stepped up with the folks is doing the banking in the box. I am officially no longer on Windows and Mac. I'm in the Linux space. So documentation and how I get it to individuals will have to be done a different way because in one of my individuals, somebody that I'm dealing with, their system has been compromised. And so I have to protect the flock. So
okay,
what I will do is I will make the documents available and then point you to where you can get them where to be safe. But do not trust.
Okay.
Because again, they're red flagging, they doing some stuff. And so a lot of folks are not getting my notices when we doing class, they're not. And
yeah, I've noticed that.
There's
myself.
There's a different, you know, I had got a message about the disk space running out, and I know where that came from because they said I exceeded it when it's supposed to be unlimited. I get that. So like everything, when you outgrow your space, you know, when you know better, you do better. And so we're doing better. Because this is finna get to the deep end, you know, I knew what making the announcement that I was going to, like, come out of the private into the public to meet trustees. That's what they've been waiting on. So I'm waiting on the disruptors to pop in, too. So I had a plan, but I can't stop. I'm on this course. So for some individuals, if I send you the material and you don't have time to read a lot of the things, it's not a deterrent. It's just there's pieces to what you have that unlock different doors. You're running down this hallway like you're the elephant. You're off the string. What that looks like is your notary ledger, your journal, that's the saving grace. Your journal is what it looks like. The commercial registry is what it looks like. That's what the prize is. Like John D. already, you know, his most prized possession out of all the wealth he created with Standard Oil was ledger number one. Because without ledger number one, everything else means nothing. So your notary journal is ledger number one, is ground zero. That's what it looks
like. I yield the floor. I yield.
All right. Let's circle back around. Let's see. All right. Big bro, we got a little bit of time left. I hope I didn't keep you too long. 1796, are you ready?
Hello.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
All right. Checking in to see. Hello. I was checking in to see if you actually found the section that you was trying to review with me earlier. I was circling back to you.
Yes, I did.
Okay, good deal.
All right. And it says, it talked about the immunity of the agent.
Mm-hmm.
I keep losing it. Well, basically what it says is the actual broker agent is supposed to act totally on the behalf of the client, whether the client is a person, entity, business entity, or trust.
Correct.
So with that being said, that's not just for the real estate contract. That's with brokers, with banks too as well, and with the client actually being the actual entity they work for. So with that being said, with the broker agent that's working on the behalf of our trust, and with us being the trustee, and we giving the actual broker our resolution on how we're going to construct this deal, we put it in a trust agreement form with him to sign and we notarize, you can go ahead, because I'm not going to sign that Texas real estate agreement.
In my opinion, you would construct an operating agreement spelling out his fiduciary duties that you would have him endorse.
Okay. All right. Now, with that being said, the conversation was had about lawful legal money, but
correct.
The conversation was had about the beneficiary being the seller. We did have that conversation.
Okay.
Now, with the title company, we're at the point now where we have done the negotiations And there's a contract being presented that we have not signed, we haven't touched yet or anything. Now, do we amend or construct? Now, in my resolution, we can reconstruct any contract, any trust agreement put before us. That's in our resolution, and it can be presented. Also, too, in the minutes, we have constructed our own way of how we can obtain this property, too, as well.
Correct. So I would definitely put my stipulations on top of what's being done, because if anything in a contract is being presented that doesn't address those areas or they don't expound, like, here's what you got to pay attention to in every contract. Most contracts, a good contract is going to have a definition page. So when they say person, this is what they mean. When you say money, they know what you mean. So if you don't see that in the contract, then you need to create that. Or you need to come up with your own definition page. Like when we say earnest money or money, this is what we mean. You know, so you got to put your claim on top.
Okay. All right. Now we're learning. We learned today with a conversation with the broker agent where they where they're used to having the authority, because we're thinking that they have common knowledge of the real estate space when they don't. Reason being is because the client actually has the most interest in the real estate space than the actual agent himself. We know that now.
Correct.
Okay. Now, when we do this presentment to the broker that will be representing our trust, and we let him know that we need the 90-day CTR reports from the title company. That is, we put that in the document too as well, right?
I would.
Okay, you would?
Yes, I would. The thing about it is, as a fiduciary, you got to stay in your lane of most protected, because if they got CTRs, the monies that anybody's looking to deal with is already within that parameter. Without it, listen to this. We still going to do that. It's just I got to do it from my side of fence. So if you got it, great. You don't, here you go.
Okay.
It's about control. Now, it's about control.
My next question is, we get past that point, they produce the CTR reports, and now with the portion of the CTR report that I looked up, I'm going to read it to you right now. All right. Perform. Here you go. Blah, blah. And it's actually 11. Hold on a second. No, it's actually part three of the CTR report. Line 37 through 49, and they speak about financial institution transactions take place. Now, the name of the financial institution will be, is it the our person or would it be the trust?
The trust.
Okay, and the EIN number.
If you have one, or your own 9-digit identifier, whatever you're using to identify the trust.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Now, Now, I remember you saying, and I read myself, they say that an entity or person cannot be a financial institution, right? But they say that a trust company.
All right. Let's back into that. On the CTR, if you read the definition of a person, you'll see that a person is a financial institution. You know, every time they use the word person, they're referring to financial institutions. And there's seven types of financial institutions, a trust being number one and number seven being an individual. Number one being the most protected institutions, number seven being the least protected.
When you look
at the CTR, pay a close attention to the CTR, because, and I'm going to bring it up for everybody to see what I'm about to say. All right. When you go down to the instructions where it says who must file, It says each financial institution other than a casino, which means a casino is a financial institution also. It's just a different type, which instead must file a Form 103. So casinos got to do a Form 103, and post offices got to do a 103. Every other financial institution has got to be a 104. And this is for each deposit, withdrawal, exchange, or other payment or transfer by, through, or to the financial institution, which involves a transaction of currency more than $10,000. Now, here's where people get lost at. Multiple transactions must be treated as a single transaction if the financial institution has knowledge that, one, they are by or on behalf of the same person. Now, I want every time you hear the word person, they are not talking about you're a person as a sentient soul. Because when you come over to the definition of the word person on the CTR, a person is an individual, corporation, partnership, trust, or estate, joint stock company, association, syndicate, joint venture, or other unincorporated organization or group. So every time they use the word person on this form, they're making you a financial institution, and you're either one of those seven. So every financial institution has to do a CTR. Now, if your attorney, whoever they're dealing with, don't know their financial institution, what did I tell notaries? You can't give people what? Legal advice. You can give them the terrible advice. It's not for you to debate. It's for you to refer to this form and like, look, if you talk about currency and Federal Reserve notes, and I show you this report, you never filled it out, you committed about five felonies. And I have to back up slowly. I can't run from you. I just got to back up. Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing it that way? Well, I can't give you no education, but I'm letting you know that if you have been dealing in transactions, I didn't write the code. I'm just a fiduciary that must abide by it. You know, this is a treasury form. This application is a trust agreement between you, Department of Treasury, and FinCEN stands for the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. So you have a trust agreement with the Department of Treasury and the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. And if you're dealing with the Federal Reserve notes, you need to have this filled out before you even touch Federal Reserve notes. Not like, all right, we go down to the part three where it says financial institution where transactions take place. So if you was a debtor, then you would put ABC Bank. But because you're a creditor, you're going to put your ABC Trust. Then you're going to put the address of the trust. You're going to put the city, state, and zip code of the trust. Then you're going to come to line 39, which is going to talk about the EIN or SSN. You're going to put that in there. Then they're going to ask you for the routing number. You're going to put that routing number. Then they're going to want a date of signature. You're going to put that date. Then they're going to need the title of proven official. Well, if you're the trustee, what title are you using in number 44? Trustee. Then it's going to ask for the signature of the approving official. That's going to be the signature of the trustee. And then you're going to have the date of the signature. Then you're going to have the type or print preparer's name. That means that you may have an officer or a notary that prepared this, which means then you're going to sign off as John Doe, the notary. You're going to put their contact information, their phone number, and then you can attach a notary seal to this. At the end of the day, this form determines who goes home and who goes to jail. Why? Because the number 36 trustees, like, I don't get my panties in a bunch, quote unquote, if you put numbers in 26, 27, and 27A, because I understand what you're doing. But my accounting side of me gets really crazy when I see numbers in this, because if you know better, you do better. You know that dealing with cash is not a gap item, so don't you dare put it on this CTR. You go to number 36 and you call what your transactions, general intangible. And then you spell out the value. Now, all this cash, you just put zeros in that, because zeros don't mean there's nothing. That means the account is what? Balanced. I love when you put zeros where cash is supposed to go, because that doesn't mean that tells me that you passed the test. you know that the accounts are balanced. You're collecting taxes. If you're trying to help her stick a number in to where cash at, you're on a one-way ticket. All they got to do is present something in such a way where you don't see the danger. Like, this form is governed under the BSA, which is what? The Bank Secrecy Act. Like, there's a code you're supposed to put on this form based upon the it says inter-regulator or BSA examiner code. When you go down to the instructions, now tell me which one of these codes you're going to use when you do your CTR. All right, you got a regulator or BSS examiner code number one, and that's for the Comptroller of Currency. You got code number two, which stands for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC. Then you got code three, which is for the Federal Reserve System. Then you got code four for the Officer or Thrift Supervision. That's number four. Number five, you got the National Credit Union Association. That's number five. You got code number six. That's for Security and Exchange Commission. Then you got code number seven, and that's for the Internal Revenue Service. Then you got code number eight. That's for the United States Postal Service. You got code 10, I mean 9, excuse me. That's for the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. And then last but not least, you got code 10, which is state regulator. Trustees, which codes are you going to use on your CTR?
Hold on a second.
Aren't you collecting taxes on behalf of the estate?
Yes.
So doesn't the IRS, isn't they your business partner?
Yes.
So you need to be using code 7. Ain't 7 the number of completion?
Yes.
Okay.
Wow. Wow.
That's why this form is very important. It shouldn't be taken lightly, and I apologize. I haven't been really on it like I once was. It's just that with this COVID stuff, we've been a little bit distracted. We're trying to help families get out of harm's way. But nonetheless, we're here. And for anyone who has missed this, they can always go to the archives and listen. And I will share this video when we get everything up in the other network. Any other questions, big bro?
I guess now it's just, I guess, structuring the REIT and putting together a agreement, trust agreement per the agent and putting the trust request and assert our authority in that request, and if they don't abide by that that request, the contract will be null and void.
Correct.
Trust agreement will be null and void.
Correct. I got you.
Okay.
All right. All righty.
Okay.
All right.
I appreciate that.
All righty, big bro. I appreciate everybody definitely giving us your input. They just ended this class, so I appreciate everybody's time and energy. Peace and love, family. Peace and love.